to 2:01 a.m. These business people out there in their meeting till 2:01 a.m. There was another meeting on September 5th. And then finally, the salary schedule itself was adopted on September the 16th. Now, you have before you, turning to the contract issue, you have before you a supplement to continuing contract agreement. And this has been called a contract by the plaintiffs. As the name implies, this is a supplement to a continuing contract. This is not a contract. It contains no job duties. It contains no number of days that the teacher will work, which is required by statute. This is a supplement. It can't be read in isolation. In an appendix to the surprise brief, the contract itself, the underlying continuing contract, is set forth. There, the language is, the district agrees to pay the teacher for all the services rendered under this contract a salary at the annual rate as fixed by the schedule of teacher salaries as adopted by the Board of Trustees, in no event less than the state of Texas minimum foundation salary. Further, in our brief, in response to the application for writ of error, we cite authority holding that operational policies of the board, which are adopted by the board, become part of the employee's employment contract. In those operational policies, which are set out in our brief, it is provided that the teachers will be paid minimum state base plus local increment, if any. I think you can't read this one-page document, which contains no job duties, no number of days, in isolation. It has to be read with the underlying contract and with the board policies. Under all of these documents, the board retains the same flexibility as it does under the statutes. This case is different from the Hitchcock case. In that case, the lady had a piece of paper which had an express number of days written on it. The Hitchcock opinion at page 706 turns on this concept that it talks about specific terms in a continuing contract. The Hitchcock contract was like a simple promissory note. Our case was not. The most glaring difference between our case and the Hitchcock case is that our teachers were advised, and the minutes appear in our brief, that when the inflated 84-85 salary schedule was adopted and then rescinded and then adopted again, even though it contained skips and errors and rewarded people with less seniority more than people with more seniority for 1 year only, it was decided in that case that for morale or for whatever purpose, the district would go ahead and adopt the 84-85 schedule after the start and stop, despite the errors, but that was conditioned on the payment of those figures for 1 year only. Now, we talked about Gladys Byram as an example of someone who received a salary cut. Her case is talked about in the record in request for admissions, and then reading Dr. Allen's deposition, it can be seen that in 1983-84, her salary was $17,820. Now, when the 84-85 year schedule was adopted, through ERA, she received a jump to $23,700 under documents that were provided to the superintendent and used by his staff in developing that salary schedule. That was an error to put her up so high in 84-85. Instead, again, from the documents attached to Dr. Allen's deposition, she should have been put at $18,860 for that year. Now, when 85-86 rolled around and the district eliminated these skips and jumps and errors and devised a perfectly graduated scale tied to years of service, her salary became $21,860. So that, in the normal scheme of things, without the 84-85 year mistake, she would have received gradual increases at each year. Under the salary schedule as it was refined, she received a bonus, a banner year in 84-85, and then a decrease in 85-86, but that put her on this gradual scale that has continued. It is our position that this document, when read in conjunction with the policies and also with the underlying contract itself, is definite. It does satisfy the state statutes as they are written today, and it provides the teacher at all times with an assurance of making the minimum state base. Thus, the compensation for that teacher is set, it's defined, it's enforceable, and it's at least reasonably certain, to use the language of a case cited by the amicus in this case. What the plaintiffs desire in this case is not an application of contract law, in the district's opinion, it is the creation of new contracts, and this court has held that this court may not add to or modify written contracts, and I have cited authority for that proposition. Turning just for a minute to the logical extension of the plaintiff's argument, let's say that something that I'm missing in the statutes or the contracts gave these teachers a reasonable expectation of entitlement to receive the same local increment in 85-86. Let's say, for argument, that happened. To deprive the teacher of that or to change that, as the plaintiff's argument goes, due process would be required. Here, according to the surprise brief, there were 107 teachers with salary cuts. I'm not sure the record supports that, but nevertheless, that statement was made.
The brief of October 13, 1988 was so-called surprise brief.
Yes, Your Honor, the one that was filed last week.
It doesn't cite any authority. It just reflects the record. Do you desire to reply to it?
I think I have sufficiently done so this morning.
All right.
But let's say that due process was required and that there were 107 teachers with pay cuts. Let's say on a good night the board could hold four individual adversarial hearings to litigate community sentiment, financing from Austin, and all the other considerations that went in to the change in salaries. On a good night, four hearings, 107 teachers, that would require over 25 nights of hearings by these board members who are local businessmen and women in the community who did the best they could under the circumstances in this case. We respectfully request that the Court of Appeals' opinion be affirmed. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, ma'am.
May it please the Court, David Richards and Truman Dean, who's here representing plaintiff intervenors, who are essentially in the same stance as plaintiffs, representing teachers in the Lumberton District. I don't want to overcomplicate this case, but I do think perhaps it's been rendered in too simplistic form by perhaps counsel for the district. There is a problem here, and the problem is one, obviously, fairness in part. It's also a problem trying to make sense out of this statutory scheme along with the Texas Constitution, and I'd like to talk a second about that, if I may. There is, at least it seems to us, at bedrock, the problem that's identified right now, and that is, as of August 1st, if the Texas statutory scheme is indeed enforceable, these teachers were, from that point forward, trapped in employment for a year. They could do nothing. They could not seek employment elsewhere. If, in fact, the district did not release them from their contracts, they had the penalty of, one, cancellation of their teaching certificate, a valuable property right, I believe, despite what you may have said in the TCAT case, I think in this circumstance, the property right. They were could not seek employment in any school district in Texas. Now, one of the liberty interests we traditionally have talked about under the Texas Constitution, of course, is the right to pursue your profession. Now, these are important rights, and it's not one that we just wish away by saying the district was having some problems over there figuring out how it was going to finance its budget for the year. And while I guess I'm at it, there's a statutory scheme that's in place here, too, which says to the district, and you look at the statute, the district is supposed to have a budget in place by statute by August 20 of each year. There is a scheme here. By August 1st, they figured out what they're going to pay their teachers. By August 20, they're going to have their budget in place, and people are going on with the school year. Now, that did not happen here. It did not happen for whatever reason, and the result was on September 15th, or 16th, if it was, when the district, for the first time, and that was the first time anyone even saw a salary schedule, popped out a salary schedule, which had significant adverse financial impact on 100 or more teachers within the district. Now, council says, well, due process, we'd have to hold hearings and all of this. I'm not too sure that, I guess, due process is a variety of things. But one thing it is under the Texas Constitution is that it says, I think, in Article 1, Section 19, that no person, no citizen, shall be deprived of life, liberty, property, or in any manner disenfranchised except by due course of law of the land. Well, I'm not sure this is the only solution to this case, but the first one that jumped up at me is that minimally, absolute minimum at that stage, the district must have said to these people, look, we realize if we, in this circumstance, you're being trapped into an unfavorable agreement that you may want to be free from. Now, we have decided we can't pay you what you may have thought you were going to get paid, so as of today, at least, you're free to go elsewhere if you want to. If you want to stay, this is all we can pay you. Now, that, at least, is what one would might think of as a form of due process, to say to someone, we can't hold you like gray a rabbit in a tar baby. You're trapped here forever because of the Operation Texas School Law and the fact that we didn't get our act together and figure out our budget before mid-September when you had begun employment with the district and had foreclosed the possibility of any future employment. That's at minimum. I think I would like to proceed to arguments, and maybe I went about this backwards, which I think will maybe get us even farther down the road. Seems that a contractual question and a due process question are necessarily intertwined.
Can I ask you a question about the contract question?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly.
The respondent has said you must read the supplement in conjunction with the underlying contract, in other words, the four corners rule, that you cannot look at this document isolated by itself. What would be your response to that?
I think that would be correct, Your Honor. I think they're to be read, but this, I would say that at least they are to be read together and to be reconciled. The supplement, however, makes a promise, which is a promise greater than the underlying contract, and that promise is that these teachers are going to be paid plus local increment, whatever that term is. And so I assume the underlying continuing contract merely is a recitation of the statute. That is, that you're going to be paid statewide minimum. They're going to be required to pay statewide minimum by Texas law, not by virtue of contract. The supplement supplies whatever, it seems to us, salary term is to be read here, to wit, the local increment. And it's the ascertainment of that local increment, it does seem to me, that is one of the issues, at least in this case. Does that answer your question?
Were there any teachers that were not paid any local increment?
I was not present, probably. No. And I guess, I think I will say, Your Honor, I don't want to represent that. I think local increment is fairly commonplace in this, I mean, I think throughout the universe of school districts. Now, there are very few, I think, that are at only the state minimum. It was the ascertainment of the local increment, and all teachers got it. Some got more, and many got less, and that's what produced this controversy. At least there are two contractual principles of contract law that we ought to at least keep in mind here. This contract was drafted not by the teachers, but obviously by the district. We say fairly frequently that if contract is ambiguous in its terms, that the burden of that ambiguity or that failure falls upon the drafter. So at least that principle operates here. We have other principles, and that is contracts often do have to refer elsewhere to ascertain some term, and that's not unusual in Texas contract law. And at least one reading of this document is that if a person received it and said, I'm going to be paid my salary required by minimum foundation plus local increment, there is at least at that point in April of 1985 a local increment that could be ascertained, to wit, the one I'm being paid right now. Now that would be one way a court could write that into this contract if it chose. I'm not saying it has to, but at least that would be a possible construction. So a term could be supplied, that is, existing local increment for each of these teachers. And I think one question is, should it be supplied? I mean, is it a proper function of the court to try to do that at this juncture? And this is where I think I would say to the court, or we would say to the court, that if we're going to take this statutory scheme, we're going to take what happened here, if it's going to be a burden fall on someone, it sure doesn't seem to me under this statutory scheme that it ought to fall on the backs of teachers who are then continue with no other information other than that supplement up to August 1st, at which point I think it's fair to assume under our statute any other employment is foreclosed from, not only as a matter of state statute, but as a matter of reality. That's when school districts by that point in the year have already made their teaching commitments for the year. So these teachers both practically and legally were foreclosed on August 1st from seeking employment elsewhere, at least within the teaching profession. On August 26th, they began employment. Still no notice that their local increment was going to be their salary, personal salary, is going to be any different than it was the previous year. That, it seems to me, and that's in pursuant to a statutory scheme that contemplates that that district is supposed to have in place by that time its budget for the year. Now, they don't always have them in place, but that's the scheme, that it would be in place. And so if we take the statute and we take what happened here, whether we have created a contract which has that term in it, counsel has given you the case himself, and I think Roth here is an interesting case. Minimally, the district has created the kind of expectancy that Roth does talk about in terms of property interest. I'm quoting now from counsel's brief to the school district. It is the purpose of the ancient institution of property to protect those claims upon which people rely in their daily lives. Well, I would say to you that it seems to me, in this case, these teachers had by August 26th placed very substantial reliance in their daily lives on a salary that was going to be no worse than it was the previous year. I mean, these people are renting houses and doing whatever else they do, making plans for the year, and more importantly, had made a plan, not a plan, a commitment that they weren't going to go elsewhere for employment. Now, that's what they in their daily lives had done. Now, if that's not the kind of expectancy, and a reasonably well-founded one, and keep in mind that Roth doesn't talk about creating property rights by rigid regulation, it creates property rights on reasonable expectations based upon actions of public bodies. Now the public body here, that is the Lumberton School District, had done a number of things and failed, more importantly, to do other things that created, it seems to us, just that sort of reasonable expectation. They had tendered them a supplement which said you're going to get local increment. They had never told these teachers at any time, don't count on it, you're not going to get it, it's going to be different from last year. They just left them sitting there, sitting right through August 1st, sitting right through up to August 26th when they began work. Now, counsel said they're being surprised by the fact somehow that we now assert to point out the fact that on August 26th they adopted the budget from the previous year. That's just pointed out to be one more action on the district's part that gulled these teachers, if that's a term or appropriate term, into thinking that we've got ourselves a salary for the coming year. I can rent this house and pay $200 a month beginning August 1st, or beginning September 1st, because I'm going to be paid this much for this year.
Now, well, that... I have a problem here, and help me with it. It's conceptual with me, and that is, you're making a due process argument with respect to contractual rights.
Well, I guess I'm going to make both rights. I guess I want to make... I'm trying to be, and I probably have run them together too fast. I think there's a contractual right here. A contractual right, and I started this by saying I think the court can supply the term of the contract as a contractual right. To wit, when the supplement said plus local increment, we don't have any trouble ascertaining what local increment was. There was one in existence at that time. To wit, the existing local increment. And we could look outside and we could determine that. And we could apply contract principles to say that this contract, if ambiguous or indefinite in term, is to be construed most strictly against the person who drafted it, to wit the school district, and we are going to do that. And we're going to say that the district is a stop as a contractual matter to urge any other construction in light of the fact that they let these teachers continue right up through August 1st, start work on August 26th, and never said the contract term is something other than
my
we make it to be.
Relate to that.
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That has to do with the constitutional right to a property.
Okay, contracts and contracts.
Which is your second prong.
All right, clearly.
And I have trouble seeing how the right to a job rises to constitutional dimensions.
Well, I think.
Even if it is a right to a job.
Well, I guess I can't. That's what the Roth case is all about, I guess. That's what the Sinderman case is all about. The whole body of federal law that has emerged with respect to public employment, that the public employer can create by rule or regulation. Rossoff by this court, and that's not Rossow by this court, San Antonio public employee decided by opinion by Justice Ray last 2 years ago, it seems to me, is a case where this court recognized a property right and a public employment of a city employee in San Antonio, a property right created by rule or regulation of the public body in terms of Roth, a reasonable expectancy of continued employment. And it's reasonably clear, I think, from the cases, and I'd be happy to supply them to the court, that that property right can entail a term of employment, too, to wit. There's a salary case out of some JPs down in Brazoria County or Fort Bend County where they got a cut in salary, and the court questioned whether that was a property right. There are, not this court, but I guess it's this circuit. But clearly, a property right can emerge or coexist, it seems to me, with a contract right. I mean, I guess that's what I would say to you. You may have a contract right, and with a public employer, that contract right may very well, seems to me, reach the level or the dignity of also a constitutional property right. We also have, to be clear here, a liberty right that's implicated in the sense that if you do what the district says you do, the right of this person to contract, be it liberty to go sell their employment, is literally destroyed for 1 year. Now, that's the other piece, it seems to me, of the constitutional right that's implicated. I hope I've answered.
Do you think that helps elevate it to a constitutional right, the fact that you can't go get other employment when you're hired by a public institution?
Well, I think liberty in the Constitution means the right to pursue your chosen profession. I mean, the 13th Amendment says suppose the whole issue of enforcement of personal employment contracts always implicates to some degree. But here, that's private people. This is the state saying to someone, to a citizen, your liberty is restrained for 1 year.
Counsel on the other side said, well, but the school district can, they might give you permission.
They might. And that might answer, but they didn't. They didn't say to them, that's one of the things that didn't happen here. They didn't say to them, come on down here, we're in a tight. We're going to have to cut back, but you're free to go on your own. Whether that would answer the question, I don't know, but as I started to say, that's a minimum requirement that you don't tie somebody up and set their feet on fire and just say you're going to have to sit here. I mean, there has to be some point at which you say to them, you're free to go on down the road because we can't pay you what we led you to believe we were going to pay you. Now, whether that's a total answer here, I don't know, but that is at least at bedrock, it seems to be the minimum that's wrong.
Even if the school district said that at that point in time, wouldn't it be impossible for the teachers to find employment elsewhere?
That is the harsh reality that most districts have already made their employment commitments by that time of the year.
So
one could argue that it would be, well,
it would be relief without substance.
But it might not be. And at least there is, we never treat a constitutional right as being insubstantial. And that's what I guess I want to say here. I think it is a constitutional right, which to me is never, I'm sure, insubstantial.
Any further questions? Thank you. The court will take another minute. All in favor, aye.